This is the Microsoft Cloud Show, Episode 8, where we'll go over the latest news in Azure, Office 365, and Amazon.
Welcome to the Microsoft Cloud Show, the only place to stay up to date on everything going on in the Microsoft Cloud world, including Windows Azure, Office 365, Exchange, Link, and other related technologies. Just the information, no marketing, no BS. I'm Andrew Connell.
And I'm Chris Johnson.
And we're just two dudes telling you how we see it.
Good day, Mr. Johnson. How are you doing?
Very well, very well. I see. How are you?
Doing good. Here's our eighth show here. We're getting some great responses from people. So let's kind of kick it off. And I want to ask, what have you been up to lately?
Well, it has been a busy last kind of couple of weeks for me. I've done a bunch of training through various different events. I did a live streamed Microsoft Virtual Academy on core SharePoint development. That was, gosh, I say two Fridays ago now. And that was kind of crazy. That was my first time doing it. It was live streamed out. We had about 1,000 people on the stream at the sort of at the high point. And that was, yeah, a whole day of talking. So I was pretty whacked at the end of that. And then straight from there, you know, we ended up at both you and I ended up at SharePoint Intersections last week. So that was that also went really well. That was in Las Vegas, and had a whole bunch of we did a full day workshop together, obviously, and then had a few sessions during the week. So again, lots and lots of talking. And then just to cap it off, I flew from there to Chicago and went to SharePoint Saturday Chicago, which I got to say was one of the best SharePoint Saturdays I've been to in quite some time. It was at the Hard Rock Hotel in downtown Chicago, and my favorite coffee shop just around the corner, Intelligentsia. So it was a great experience.
Very
cool. How about you?
I guess, yeah. So like you, I was in at the Intersections Conference last week in Las Vegas. This week I've been a little bit of after being gone for a week, and you spend, it seems like a day trying to get caught up and get things organized. And I've been plugging away trying to get the last few modules of my advanced workflow class I'm building for Pluralsight buttoned up and churned out. But then I guess the other big thing they've been doing is that we referenced it a couple episodes ago, is this SaaS product that I'm working on. So I think we'll talk a little bit more about it in the next episode. By then, by the time we release the next episode, it'll be a little bit more public and people will see some information on our blogs by then. But we'll talk a little bit more about it then. I don't want to use the podcast as the marketing vehicle for it, but just want to mention what's going on. But I guess that's basically me this week. I guess I'm home for 2 weeks to work on this Pluralsight course to try and get it shipped as soon as I can. And then I guess you and I are going to be with some friends in Austin, Texas for the F1. And then followed by that, I've got another conference in Orlando that I'll be doing. So busy month of November.
It's going to be good to get together in Austin. You know, hey, we might as well do a pod show recording while we're there.
Why not? We got a couple of people that they probably just kind of jump in and say a few things, but
good time. Excellent.
So there's just two things I just want to mention too before we dive into the actual episode here, is that one, you know, a lot of people that are listening to us now are probably subscribing to us either through the RSS feed that is available on our site, the MicrosoftCloudShow.com, or through iTunes. If you like what you hear, I know we've only had seven other episodes prior to this one. And granted, the first few of them were all intro stuff. But you know, we'd love to get any kind of reviews, any kind of feedback from you. So reviews in iTunes are always highly appreciated. The 5-star reviews are appreciated a bit more than the 1-stars, obviously. But any feedback is good to hear from you. And then again, too, you know, we're on Twitter. I don't think we have our pod show doesn't have a whole lot of followers here, but we're just mscloudshow.com. Sorry, mscloudshow. The Twitter is at mscloudshow. I might get that right the third time. So people just, you know, if you're listening to us, you like it, just tweet us up. Just kind of help us spread the word. Let people know about the show.
Yeah, follow us on Twitter or, you know, take a look at the MicrosoftCloudShow.com and sign up for the feeds to get notifications of new episodes and also the blog up there as well.
Yep. And don't forget to send in those questions, too. We will be adding questions. Although in this episode, I think we're going to forego questions because we got a lot of news we want to get through. And so it's probably a pretty good segue into the main segment of the show.
Good call. Yeah, here we go.
All right. So, man, this episode was we had some other ideas for what we're going to cover in this episode, and we just got overloaded with cloud-related news, it seems, in the last 2 weeks. We started putting stuff together in this OneNote page that we have, and next thing I knew, I turned around, and we had so many bullet points. I'm like, well, we better just take the subject of the next show and just kind of punt it one more down the road. We got enough stuff we got to cover here, huh?
Yeah, there's been tons going on, tons and tons. So why don't we dig in and chew through some of this news?
Absolutely. So I think, you know, so far on the show, all we've really talked about is SharePoint and Office 365. And again, you know, the show is all about the cloud or the Microsoft cloud, and then also what the competitive landscape looks like. And while Office 365 and SharePoint are definitely pieces of that, they're just that. For what we want to cover, just pieces. And so let's first start here with some stuff that came out on the Windows Azure side. So in the show notes, we're going to link to Scott Guthrie's post. Scott Guthrie is one of the main guys on the Windows Azure team at Microsoft. And he had a blog post that came out on November the 4th that talked about a bunch of new stuff that they did, that they've added to Azure. These guys are on a tear right now. Can you see how much stuff they're doing these days?
Oh, it's crazy. I just don't know how they do it. You know, they're absolutely crushing it. And usually they've got news every 2 to 3 weeks of new things that are coming out. And they're just on an absolute, like, crazed rampage of new features. They're doing a great job. And it's really, really exciting to see.
Yeah. So one of the things they did, and this one, it always kind of beat me up a little bit. Because I know we've been able to do something akin to this and on the Amazon side or on the AWS side. And that's the ability to ship Microsoft our data instead of just having to upload it. So, you know, let's say for those of you that are in, you know, let's just say you have a bunch of virtual machines. Like, for example, if you're on the SharePoint side and you've got 4 or 5 VMs that you want to upload to Microsoft and you want to run them in Azure. And those things can be anywhere from 15 to 60, 70, 80 gigs. And you can't really splice those up into different pieces. So, it's been a real painful thing to kind of move environments up. I see a lot of people end up having to rebuild them from scratch. What they now have is an ability to do what they call import-export of hard drives. And really what this is that you're going to take your VHD files for your hard drives. And they've got a couple different security options that are available to you. You can encrypt them with BitLocker and stuff like that. But following their procedure, you can set up a job where you effectively are going to be shipping on a USB drive or an external drive, something that contains your VHDs up to the Windows Azure team via Federal Express or FedEx. And they will take the data off of your drive and mount it, load it up for you right inside of your blob. So you can use those for your VMs.
That's pretty cool, right? Especially for VHDs that kind of get a crazy size. The other interesting use that I've been thinking about is for customers that are like bulk archiving a whole bunch of documents, like terabytes and terabytes of documents, and not doing it into something on-prem. You know, they want to do it into private blob storage or something like that. That also is another really good option.
Yeah, that's something I did. I have a NAS device in my home office that I've been using. It's got, by default, it's got some integration with AWS and their blob storage, their S3 storage. They don't have any integration with Azure yet. So what I had done, I was doing the same thing, and I had about 4 terabytes that I wanted to upload into my S3 for backup and archival. And it was ridiculous to try and upload that stuff. And so they had a cool feature that did the exact same thing. I just put everything on a couple 3 terabyte drives, sent them up to Amazon. They loaded it all inside of one container. And then from there, I just kind of used their web interface to move things around. And this is going to give you a similar kind of capability in Azure, just a much more feature parity between the platforms.
So. Yeah, it's funny, you know, and that even though we've got you know, fiber to the home and cable, decent internet speeds to the office and all that sort of stuff. I had a great computer science professor who once said that never underestimate the bandwidth of a van full of hard drives going down the freeway. And it's the same kind of thing, right?
I saw that same comment when this was announced. I saw the same comment on Facebook from a few people just going, yeah, never underestimate a station wagon filled with hard drives driving down the highway.
Yeah, it's so true.
Yeah.
So what else was announced?
So there's a lot of stuff. There's two things that I really wanted to touch on that I think are really cool. The rest of them, I think I'll let everybody go jump over to the post that Scott Guthrie put up, and we'll link to that in the show notes. I'm going to leave the really cool one for the end. But one of the ones I did is an Azure scheduler.
Ooh, yeah.
And so what this one's going to do is we had the ability to do this with Azure before, but it was always with like external services. But what this is effectively going to allow you to do is to build up little jobs and then specify when you want them to run. And it's pretty cut and dry. That's all it does.
Yeah, it's kind of like a cron job if you come from the Unix world or
scheduled tasks,
sort of
AT and stuff. Yeah. So I think it's a huge thing. It's kind of like one of those low hanging fruit things. It's surprising that it took this long to get it. But it kind of came out of left field. So you saw it like going, it's really cool, but yeah, okay. That's kind of expected.
Yeah. And I think people were having to roll their own in Azure, with worker roles and, using things like quartz.net. Have you heard of that? It's a sort of a library and database and so forth that lets you put jobs in it, then get notified when they're ready to go.
Yeah. And that stuff's pricey too. You're running those cron jobs and stuff. That stuff gets, on a worker role, and it can get pricey, especially because you have to run it nonstop with just a little while loop or something. It's not fun.
Yeah. The cool bit about the Azure scheduler is it gives you some options, right? It can just, it can call a web service endpoint when a job gets fired, mm-hmm. like when a task is scheduled. So that makes it easy if you've got a web service and some site that you're running that you need to, I don't know, do like refresh a cache maybe or something else. So you can hit that endpoint. Or you can also put jobs, put a job on a queue as well, on a service bus queue. So you can, the good thing about that is web services are okay to call for short running jobs, right? You ping them, they do something and they respond. But if you've got to do a long running task, then you want to put a job on a queue and then maybe a worker role picks the job up off the queue and does some long running task, you know, number crunching or whatever the job happens to be. Yeah. So it's nice to have both of those options with the scheduler.
Yeah. Yeah. You can't just, if it's a long running thing, I mean, you're going to run into the problem where eventually your connection's going to get timed out and it's just going to get dropped. It's not going to be left open forever, but
yeah.
So the other,
for just before we move on to the really cool one is for all the SharePoint people out there, I think the scheduler is really interesting because of timer jobs. For those who aren't familiar with what timer jobs are in SharePoint, it's kind of like the same thing as a scheduler, right? You register a timer job and every once in a while it'll go do some work. And for those of us moving to SharePoint in the cloud, this is a bit of a problem because timer jobs are what's, you know, you need to be a full trust solution, which isn't available in Office 365. And so the Azure scheduler, I think, will give people the choice or flexibility to, you know, run jobs on a timed basis and do things in you know, Exchange Online or SharePoint Online as well.
Yeah, I agree. That's a big one. It's funny because it's, you know, Microsoft creates these things called timer jobs inside of SharePoint. They don't really tell anybody about them. I remember when they were added to the product, there was no documentation, and I just kind of went on a little tear to try and figure out how these things worked and how you could create your own, put a blog post up about it. And it still is one of my number one posts that people keep coming back to. And you keep getting questions about it. And like, you're the timer job expert. I'm like, these things are really cut and dry. They're not that, I wouldn't consider myself an expert at this. It's not too tough, but yeah. So the other one that they added, now this one is just, this is really
ludicrously cool.
Yeah. This to me, this brings Azure development to just being such a first-class kind of developer experience now. With all the changes we had in Visual Studio 2013, with all the new additions we've had in the Azure SDK that they've just released in the last week or two, version 2.2 of it, now we have remote debugging. And so now, within Visual Studio, I can have my website up and running. And after I've deployed it to my website up to Azure Websites, which, again, it's kind of funny. It's AWS. The acronym is AWS for that, which is also the Amazon Web Services. But if I deploy my website, my .NET website, to the Azure, to an Azure website, I'll see those websites listed as nodes inside of Visual Studio's Server Explorer, the Cloud Explorer piece, and I can right-click on one of those websites, and I can just say, attach the debugger, and I can just do remote debugging straight from Azure on my local machine, having all the symbols and everything, breakpoints, watches, you name it. It is absolutely ridiculous. I mean, we've almost gotten to the point now where we don't need to be, we almost won't have to run virtual machines at all locally, or really having web servers or anything locally on our machines, which is going to make our laptops so much more secure, and leveraging these nice environments up in the cloud that we can just throw away whenever we don't need them anymore. We're only going to pay for the stuff that we use. You can be able to do, you know, a lot of development on low powered and cheap, what do they call them? Ultrabooks.
Mm. Yeah, it's, I think the really interesting points for me are around when something goes wrong in Azure, right? And I don't know if everybody's had this situation, but I've certainly run into it where you build a website and you deploy it, everything's going smoothly, and then somebody reports some problem or there's some sort of crashing going on, and you just don't get the debug output or the logging that you need. And you know, worst case scenario is you need to attach and start seeing what's going on the process. One case I hit, everything was debugging fine or running fine on my local box, running fine in test. But in production in Azure, we were hitting a problem, and we just had to start putting a whole bunch of extra debug and logging information, kind of like the old printf style, to figure out what was going wrong. And it was the most painful process. But it would be great to be able to, you know, in those catastrophic situations, be able to attach to something and be able to debug it in real time.
Yeah.
For those situations where all else fails. I think it's a huge, huge plus, both, like you say, for development, but then also figuring out what's going wrong. Because, you know, everybody says you should develop and then test in an environment that's similar to production. But you can't do that with the cloud, right? At least not locally. So any additional tools. It is also worth noting that this stuff comes out in the Azure SDK 2.2, I think the number is. Is it 2? Or yeah, 2.2. Mm-hmm. So that gets you the extra tools in Visual Studio, and does all of the extra things that you need to be able to hook up this debugging and get the nodes and all that sort of stuff in the Explorer window in Visual Studio that you need to do this.
Yeah, it's way cool. It's way cool. So there's a bunch of other things too that were in this big announcement on November the 4th. Things like billing alerts, virtual machine ACLs, continuous delivery, notification hubs, and then the other one that's really big as well that we're gonna let people just go take a look at is around developer analytics using a very common tool, a very hot tool that people are using these days called New Relic, which is now has first class support right inside of Azure. So definitely go take a look at that. We'll put the link in the show notes, or just go check Scott Guthrie's blog, which is just weblogs.asp.net/ScottGoo, ScottGu. So what other stuff did you see that in the last few weeks that you wanted to touch on?
Well, I've got some news about Google that I thought I'd briefly touch on. Google are doing some of their standard shenanigans around dropping support for really common browsers. And so Google Apps came out with a update on their blog that said they are now dropping support for IE9, and that it'd happen in a few weeks' time. And although I don't completely disagree with them that you know, eventually you have to drop support for old browsers. This is kind of a pain for businesses that use Google Apps, and they kind of do it without much warning. I mean, they've done this a bunch of different times with various things, dropping support for different browsers, dropping support for various document formats and things, and they just don't give people much of a heads up, which, you know, if you're a business, this can cause some major problems. I mean, I've still got customers that are on IE8 and are desperate to keep supporting it. So it takes businesses a long time to update and upgrade, and it wouldn't surprise me if this caused a bunch of pain for people.
Yeah, this actually exposed, this just happened in the last few days, like November, 5th or 6th or something like that. This actually opened my eyes to what their policy is on browser support, which I saw it was something along the lines of they will support the current major release of a browser plus the last rolling release. So now that IE 11 is out, they say we'll continue to support IE 10. But we're going to drop 9. So they'll keep the last two releases. I mean, it doesn't mean as much when you have something like Chrome or something like Firefox that has those incremental updates. But, you know, in one sense, I kind of look at it and I say, wow, that's a pretty bold move. But on the other side, you know, the other side of me says, I love it. I love it because you want somebody like a big dog to come out and actually say, you know, we're dropping support for this. So the world's got to move on. And, you know, we know that you're there's a significant number of our audience that are using this product, but you're going to have to upgrade if you want to continue to use our stuff. And, you know, there's, let's face it, a lot of companies have made Google mission critical to their organization, from Google Apps to Gmail and everything. Mm. And to see them, you know, Google kind of pushing them to say, you're going to have to do this to get upgraded. I don't know. I mean, I'm not feeling the pain. But I absolutely love it because it'll make our lives easier to see those older browsers go away.
Yeah, I don't really disagree with the technical decision. I think I more disagree with the business rationale behind it and the notice period that they give people. I just don't think it's quite fair to give people such short notice.
I agree. I still love it.
Yeah, me too. All right. So in other news, we've got some Office 365 news that's come out in early November. Probably the first thing I'll touch on is some changes that have gone on in Yammer. So we've seen Yammer is now available for all Office 365 Enterprise SKUs. And so there are various different plans in Office 365. There's some P plans and some E plans and so forth. And really it is just, you know, different price points and different sort of feature and feature levels and so forth. But previous to this news, Yammer was only available for Office 365 Enterprise SKU customers that were on an enterprise agreement with Microsoft. And so that's sort of a pre-arranged, pre-negotiated agreement, usually of a 3-year period, where customers buy software from Microsoft. And the problem with that is it's really only applicable for customers of 250 seats or more. Typically, customers of less than 250 seats don't have an enterprise agreement. So Yammer, they still had to purchase as a standalone product. It wasn't free to them. Whereas now, it's rolling out in November. You'll start seeing in your Office 365 admin portal the ability to turn on and provision a Yammer network for your tenancy. And it'll be free of charge, or no additional charge, I should say. It's sort of wrapped up in your Office 365 subscription. But you won't have to jump through any hoops. You won't need to sign up for a separate Yammer network with all the credit card bits and bobs and all that sort of stuff associated. And you'll get the enterprise features of Yammer as well. So things like being able to federate identity, if you're a company that uses things like ADFS, for example. Also, the ability to remove more than 5 users per month from the network is kind of a big blocker for some people on the free Yammer offering versus the enterprise offering. So you get all those enterprise features as well, which is really nice. So I think this will really help drive additional Yammer adoption to all those 365 customers.
Yeah, it's Yammer's just, they're really pushing to put the pedal down on the Yammer integration with 365. So it's the social story for SharePoint. That's definitely for sure. Microsoft's all in on it. So it's going to be interesting to see how more and more of the hooks come into it, and how many of these hooks are going to actually be available to customers that are still on-prem and use the hosted version. Well, excuse me, use Yammer, which is only available in a hosted version. So not an on-prem kind of, can I get Yammer in a box? So.
Right. Yeah. It's nice to see the sort of the cadence of improvements and integration starting to pick up a little. People have been getting a bit frustrated about news about the SharePoint and Yammer integration. And I think we're just starting to see that sort of level of activity pick up now, which is great.
Agreed. Agreed. Yeah, I noticed something else. There's two things I noticed in the on the Office 365 kind of updates. One of them, I guess one of them hit and it was kind of trickled out over the last month or so. And that's around content management around Office 365. We've had on-prem the ability to use something called the content by search web part and cross-site publishing. With some advanced search capabilities. And, you know, we saw some of those, some people on Twitter start to mention that, you know, hey, they were seeing some stuff in their Office 365 tenants, that this stuff was kind of starting to leak out. There was some discussion of it at the Redmond SharePoint Saturday about a month or two ago that it was coming. There was even some discussion on it in the in our one of our sister podcasts, the SharePoint Pod Show. Where they interviewed Neil Hodgkinson, who talked about the content by search web part coming to 365. And I think just last week I saw an announcement that the content by search web part, cross-site publishing, all that stuff is now available to us in Office 365. It really is still, I mean, the only thing I would say is that it does not give you the ability to do anonymous content. .com facing sites in 365, that still is going to be an on-prem thing.
It's a huge benefit for intranets. That it's something we've really struggled with in 365 is trying to build the same level of really content-rich, search-driven intranet experiences. And so I think, you know, it's obviously going to unlock a whole lot of people to do those things.
Agreed. Yeah. The other thing that I saw too that I thought was pretty big. It's funny. This is not really news, but it was news. So, sometime in the last few months, or maybe even farther back than that, last week when we were at the SharePoint conference, a gentleman from the SharePoint product group, Rob Lefferts, was there, and we were having a conversation about a bunch of different things, and. I can't remember how it came up, but I made some comment. I think it was in a session that I was presenting. I made a comment about the fact that the SharePoint 2013 REST API does not implement the dollar metadata operator from OData, which gives you a self-describing capability for services in SharePoint, or sorry, in an OData service. And it was a painful thing, but almost immediately after my session, Rob mentioned to me, he said, actually, that's available now in Office 365. So slipping it under our noses, you know, we've now got the dollar metadata operators available to us in Office 365 for the REST API. You can go out there, you can check it today. I've seen it. Every tenant that I've checked so far, I've seen it. But, I mean, who knows how many different versions of SharePoint are running in 365. However, what's cool about this and why I believe almost everybody probably has access to this is that Rob also followed up and said it is also in one of the cumulative updates for SharePoint 2013 for those of us who have on-prem deployments. And so there was a link to both these posts in the show notes. But Rob Windsor, a SharePoint MVP, spent a lot of time trying to get the dollar metadata thing working inside of Visual Studio to get Visual Studio to generate a proxy. And he had to do quite a bit of jumping through hoops to get that to work. I've gotten it to work. I've used it a little bit on a SharePoint hosted app, and I'm trying to get it to work with something else right now. Guy that was at the conference with us last week, Paul Schaeflein, he went through and started doing a case by case. And let's add a CU, let's add a cumulative update until we see dollar metadata show up. And sure enough, he found in the April 2013 cumulative update, which I've confirmed. I went and installed it right after I saw Rob's post. Right after I saw Paul's post. And sure enough, it's there. And I'm playing with the metadata endpoint for the REST API in my local VM.
Yeah, it's really nice. For those who aren't aware what this dollar metadata thing is that we're going on about, it's, as you pointed out, AC, it's part of the OData specification. And it basically lets you hit an endpoint, like a URL, and get back a payload that tells you where things are in the service, like what entities there are and that sort of thing, right? It it lets you kind of interrogate the service and find out what's available.
Yeah.
So it's very handy for generating proxies, and there's libraries and so forth that use that dollar metadata part of the OData spec to interrogate them and see what else is available through those endpoints.
Absolutely. So what did you see? Is there some other Office 365 stuff that you've noticed in the last few days too?
Yeah, there's been a couple of other things I want to touch on before we move on. The first is some Office web app improvements for real-time collaboration in the cloud. So this was announced, I think, on the 6th of November early on the 7th, something along those lines. And this actually uses one of my favorite technologies, Signal R. So you've probably heard a few posts from me about this before, that sort of thing. So So now in the Office web apps, much like you could have done in some Google Docs for the last wee while, you can go in and start collaboratively editing a spreadsheet and see what cell people are on and work together on a doc, which is kind of funny because for some bizarre reason, I thought this was already a thing in the Office web apps. And am I mistaken? Because I'm pretty sure this was available on-prem at least between various different web apps in one way, shape, or form. I'm sure I've done demos where I've shown somebody in Excel and Excel, you know, collaboratively editing a document before.
I swear I saw this at a keynote two SharePoint conferences ago, like 2 years ago. So I'm with you. I saw this news come out like in the last few days, and then I just sat there staring at it like, am I seeing deja vu here? Did this really happen? Because I know I've seen this demoed, and I know that I was kind of like, I thought I was an idiot because I could never figure out how to get the thing to work. Apparently it was demoed and it was never working, and now we actually get it. So
No, I mean, you can definitely do, you know, co-authoring in the full Office client.
Yeah.
But I think where the story broke down was in some of the compatibility between, you know, one author and the rich client, one author and the web app. And there was this matrix of things that did and didn't work. And I think what they're trying to say is that all of that has been ironed out.
I gotcha. Now it's not nearly as foggy. It was very cloudy.
Ta-da. and then the final thing I'll touch on is kind of a little bit of a humor point where I saw some news recently that Dynamics have some new cloud-ready software. And I was like, wow, that's cool. So CRM Online is obviously available, but some of the other Dynamics products aren't. And so I dug into this news, and so it turns out that they're saying this Dynamics product is now cloud ready, so long as you're cool with doing it in a virtual machine. And I was like, really? Is that what we're calling cloud ready now, that you can run it in a virtual machine?
In related news, Minecraft is now cloud ready.
Well, yeah, Minecraft. I was actually thinking Minesweeper, right? Because Minesweeper is now cloud ready. You could provision an A7 8-core 16 gig memory VM and play a huge Minesweeper game. That's some news, AC.
And that would be a great thing to do for one of those cross-country flights.
Yeah.
Just in Wi-Fi.
So, yeah, I don't know. I just think calling something cloud ready because it runs in a VM in the cloud, that's not really that cool. personally, I would like to see it take advantage of some cloud service or some, you know, some sort of additional features or capabilities that are enhanced by the cloud, to call it cloud ready. Because, you know, you could you could open up Minesweeper in a VM, and is that cloud ready? I don't really think so.
You know, it's kind of funny. It's kind of funny. It's the same way I look at, I know we all accept the fact that they're called mobile homes, but you see one of those things driving down the road, especially when it's been cut in half and they're driving it in two different trucks, and they're moving cars and everything out of the way and, you know, trying to get past like intersections and stuff. And it's like, yeah, that's kind of cute. But if you think that's mobile, you're out of your mind. You got to get a whole bunch of guys together, lift the thing up, throw some wheels on it, take the bricks off, and okay, here we go. Now we're going to drive down the street. Like, yeah, right. Let's see how well the China stays on the wall.
Yeah, I think just dressing it up in some different clothes doesn't really cut it for me. So I guess we'll see. You know, who knows? They might come out with some additional capabilities down the line. I definitely think the benefits of putting it on a VM in the cloud just so you don't have to run the VM locally, but calling that piece of software cloud ready, not so kosher in my book.
Doesn't pass your mustard.
No.
So I have a couple things that I noticed that came out this week, and I'm sure we're going to see more in the next 2 weeks, and that's around Amazon Web Services. Specifically, there's two things around their virtual machine story, which they call the EC2 offering. The first one they did, and this is cool. One of them I don't think that you can. I know one of them isn't available in Azure, and I think the other one I don't believe you can do this, but which means that we'll probably end up getting it in Azure down the road.
In 2 weeks, if the Azure team are anything to go by.
Exactly. Yeah. what Amazon has done is they've added in a new virtual machine instance, which is all around a GPU. So you think about the different things that people are doing where they need to do a lot of like video editing or video processing. I know that, you know, when I'm working on a class for Pluralsight, you know, building, recording the class and producing it and everything, which is basically working with everything inside the inside of my editing studio, be it Camtasia, be it Adobe Premiere. That takes a lot of time. But then the other thing that takes a tremendous amount of time is taking the actually having the software package go render everything out and build out the WMVs or whatever I'm going to end up using. It's nuts. I mean, how long some of this stuff can take. And so being able to have, you know, a whole farm of VMs that could go do the production of this stuff. I mean, I'm thinking about, think about the different studios that could use this instead of having to have, you know, huge farms and stuff put together. That's one thing they did. Another one they did, that this is the part that I'm thinking that I would see Azure. I don't think Azure can do this today, but I wouldn't be surprised if they add it down the road, is they have now a way for you to take one kind of a VM that you're using. So let's say it's an extra large VM with a certain number of cores and a certain amount of memory. And you can kind of flip a switch and say, I'm going to go from this VM to this other VM. So it's just, all you're doing is changing the configuration. So it's almost like cracking open the VM, yanking a couple memory sticks out or sticking some in, throwing a few more CPU cores in or in, and being able to change a VM kind of on the fly and change your pricing. I remember sitting in a training room one time where somebody was complaining about the fact that SharePoint was going all 64-bit. They had just bought a bunch of new 32-bit servers, and I made a little comment. I said, well, just go down to Best Buy and buy another 32 bits and throw them in all the different machines, and you'll be fine. And in a sense, I mean, Amazon was just like going, yeah, okay, we got that.
Yeah, well, you know, it's kind of like, I don't know if you've used Hyper-V much. I think you probably have, right?
Oh, yes.
There was some new stuff in Hyper-V about dynamic memory allocation, or I can't remember the right term for it.
That's correct, yes.
But basically being able to, on the fly, add and remove memory from machines, and also sort of over-allocate. It's kind of like overselling an airplane, right?
Mm-hmm.
So being able to have multiple VMs using, if you add up all the memory, they're using more than the machine has got, but sort of scaling it up and down between machines is needed.
Yeah.
So that's kind of cool. But that's really interesting, because I think that's very handy for SaaS apps or massively scalable systems that need to scale up and scale down on demand. Right, Azure has the ability to do auto scaling, but that's really just adding and removing machines or adding and removing capacity. But you can't change the size of your VM unit if you're doing that with VMs.
Yeah.
So, in my case, I've had a situation where, you know, we use quite large instances, and we scale up to, you know, 10 of them, but then we want to scale right back down. And it would also be better to be able to not just scale down the number of instances, but also the size of the instances. So that sounds really interesting.
I mean, it's kind of like what we can do with the Azure websites, right? Because we can change the size instance that our website runs on, and then we can change the number of instances. And that's effectively what Amazon's letting you do. So if you think about, and this kind of ties into the next piece I was going to mention, which is around startups. If you think about it, I mean, sometimes you don't really have a way of estimating what your capacity needs are going to be. And if you build everything out inside of a certain size VM and you find that you've over-specced it or you've under-specced it, then you've got to tear it down and build up a new VM. And as long as you're in the same kind of class, I mean, obviously there are going to be some limitations on, you know, how you can transfer from one to another one. Like, you know, you wouldn't be able to change from a choice field in SharePoint over to a date time field. It doesn't, the two data types don't really convert that well. So there'll be some limitations there, but that's pretty slick. The other thing that
I wonder if they do that in real time. Like, I wonder if memory state gets transferred. I mean, it can't, right? Because if you go from 16 gig of RAM to 4, how are they going
to
move all that across?
I started looking into it. I think that we're going to see more coming out about it in the middle of November, because there's the AWS conference, AWS Invent, is November 13th and 14th, which, I mean, that thing sells out usually almost immediately when it goes on sale. So it'll be interesting to see what news comes out of that about that. We'll definitely be covering some of that in our next show. But the other thing they've done, I mean, you know, one thing that I've noticed, and I know Microsoft does a really good job of this with their BizSpark program for new companies getting up to speed, getting up on the SharePoint or on the Microsoft platform, the Microsoft cloud. A lot of startups, Amazon has spent a lot of time recently really trying to cater to a bunch of startups. I've noticed even some news on, on Hacker News, where we've talked about some startups that have gone under because they've made themselves so elastic that they had no way to control their costs. But basically what they've done is that Amazon has created a new program called AWS Activate, and it's targeted for startups. I would consider it being like their version of Microsoft's BizSpark. In that what it does is it provides credits towards Amazon services, AWS services. They offer developer support. They have a whole startup community. They have some developer training around AWS. And then they also have a bunch of special offers from third parties and their partners that they can use to really stand up a bunch of additional things and help startups get up off the ground on the AWS platform. So I tell you, seeing the way Azure's going, I mean, we've got two really, really good people that are really good companies that are fighting for your business in the cloud space, and you see new features coming out left and right. I mean, it's a cloudy world.
It's a hot space.
And it's a great space to be in. So,
yeah, I mean, BizSpark has done really well for Microsoft. It's a really great program, and there have been some pretty notable companies that have come out of that or have used it in their early days, like Stack Overflow was one of them, I believe. They've obviously done extremely well. The other thing was that it was really interesting timing about the AWS Activate news, in that it sort of came out at about that same time as that article that you were referring to, where a startup went under when they weren't able to pay their $35,000 Amazon bill and couldn't get together more funding in time, and ended up going out of business. Mm. So I thought that was kind of curious as well.
It was funny because I saw the article on Hacker News, and then later that day I got the email from AWS about this this Activate program, and I went back and looked at Hacker News. I mean, the company put a post up on their site about how they were going out of business. They couldn't afford their bills when their bills came due at the end of the month or in the next 2 months. All their credit cards were going to be declined because they couldn't. They were already maxed out. They'd burned through all their funding. Then TechCrunch, I think it was TechCrunch or Ars Technica, wrote an article, or The Verge, one of those news magazines. They wrote an article about the behind the scenes of why they went out of business and how it happened. And if you go back and look on Hacker News, if you look at the comments for those two posts, they were all, both in the top 50 posts yesterday or 2 days ago on early November. And you look in the comments and you can see a bunch of people jumping in, and now they're like going, wait a minute, Activate may help you. You may be able to save some costs and everything. And so that story's not over for that one company. It's a cool little photo sharing or photo organization company based out of San Francisco.
Yeah.
It's a cool story.
Yeah, that's really interesting.
Yeah. So that was a lot of news we covered. This is one of our longer episodes, but I mean, there's a boatload of news we had to cover in this episode. So, I think that's everything I had to say in this one. We'll be back to just more content, probably more news next time around. So from me, that's everything I had to say. You have anything that you wanted to, any parting shots or thoughts?
No, I think that's really good. You know, we've covered a ton of news. We'll try to do these more often and catch up on some of the latest news and updates more frequently. We had a big backlog this time, but we'll try to get through them more regularly in each episode going forward, I think.
Agreed. If you have a question for us, go to microsoftcloudshow.com/questions, where you can submit it as text or record it as a WAV or an MP3 and provide a link so that we can play your question on the show. Our theme music is an excerpt from from Evaporated Eric by Monk Turner, used under a Creative Commons license. You can subscribe to us in iTunes by searching for Microsoft Cloud Show or via RSS at MicrosoftCloudShow.com, where you will also find a full transcript and show notes of each episode. You can also find us on Facebook, searching for Microsoft Cloud Show, or on Twitter at MS Cloud Show. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.